So with that, we'll kick off today's session. And again, this is day three, triad during remedial design, remedial action. It's very well known and understood that the triad toolbox is a powerful approach for conducting investigations with the underlying goal of reducing the overall investigative data uncertainty. But probably what is less known or understood is that triad, in whole or in part, is an approach that can be utilized during remedial design and implementation. That's why we focused an entire track on it during the conference that was held in June of last year. My hope that this session we will accomplish two goals as a group. First, we'll present to you two case studies where this concept will be explored. And then second, in the Q&A session, I guess I'm strongly encouraging open discussion about your experiences with this concept that are both similar and unique to the presentations given herein. We have more than enough time, I think, based on the presentations and the Q&A and the buffer time to facilitate that. So I'm encouraging that strongly. So without further ado, our first presentation will be a case study of triad's use during the RDRA process. And our second presentation will be a focused highlight on one of the specific tools in the toolbox, in this case data, that is very effective during remedial implementation. Today's first speaker is Marty Wangenstein from Bay West. Marty has over 20 years experience managing environmental and military munitions investigation and remediation projects for commercial, state, and federal clients. And as Vice President of Federal Programs for Bay West, Mr. Wangenstein is responsible for the execution of over $165 million in contract awards. Marty has a Master's of Science in both civil engineering and geology and is a registered PE and PG. And Marty will be presenting on various tools used, including Triad, as well as others, to expedite the closure of one of the sites at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. Last reminder, please place everything on mute by hitting *6. And with that, Marty, I want to turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to discuss the integration of the triad, as well as the use of innovative technologies and future-first planning into our performance-based remediation activities at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. But today, really, what I'm going to be focusing on is the use of the triad to refine the conceptual site model and develop site-specific remediation approaches. Moving on to slide 2.
Morning.
I would like to briefly acknowledge the co-authors of this presentation, namely Frank Werner of Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, Sean Cataldo with the Corps of Engineers Omaha District, and Megan Carey, now Megan Dooley, with Newfields after her recent wedding. Moving on to slide 3, please. Finally, you know, I'd like to also acknowledge additional personnel, team partners, and subcontractors whose work has greatly contributed to the project's successes to date, including the installation's receipt of the 2007 Secretary of Defense Award for environmental restoration activities at Department of Defense installations. In particular, I'd like to recognize SAIC for its technical support and TNNA for its work performing the triad investigation at one of the sites I'll be discussing today. Moving on to slide 4. At Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, Bay West was awarded a competitively bid firm fixed price contract in 2005 to achieve regulatory site closure for 16 IRP sites at the installation. We have achieved the contract goals for 12 of our 16 sites and are in track performing or for achieving the performance objectives for all of these within the contract period. And the triad, as I will like to show you today, was a very important element of our successes, especially considering some of the compressed time schedules that we had to achieve our performance objectives. For those of you who are not familiar with the term, performance-based acquisition or contracting is a mechanism that specifies the end performance objective, not the means or methods to achieve those objectives. The thought is that by giving the contractor the flexibility to develop the technical approach, the government will realize cost and schedule savings through the contractor's use of innovative approaches. A couple of other nuances of our contract is that it is a fixed price remediation insurance contract. In other words, we are required to purchase a cost overrun or cost cap insurance product to provide the government and the contractor coverage in the event of certain unforeseen site conditions. Lastly, our contractor requires us to achieve the performance objectives, which by and large are site closure within 5 years of notice to proceed for a particular site. Moving on to slide five. At Seymour Johnson, our these are performed under three different regulatory programs within the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, or NCDENR. And as you can imagine, each of the programs has its nuances. For example, the underground storage tank program recognizes and utilizes risk-based cleanup approaches, whereas the inactive hazardous sites branch program really does not. For example, the risk-based cleanup criteria for benzene in the underground storage tank program is 5,000 micrograms per liter. They call that the gross contaminant level. The benzene cleanup criteria in the inactive hazardous sites branch program, which is also referred to as the 2L standard, is 1 microgram per liter. So again, the regulatory program that our site happened to fall in was made a significant difference as to what techniques we used to investigate as well as to remediate the sites. Slide six. The West site closure strategy is based on a marriage of initiatives listed in the slide, some of which I'll briefly discuss during today's presentation. Slide seven. First, I'd like to discuss is Future First Planning. Future First Planning, or F2P, was a U.S. Air Force Air Combat Command initiative incorporating the site's future use early into the site investigation and cleanup strategies development. And although it may sound like a no-brainer, this approach really represented a fundamental shift in policy within the Air Force, where the environmental restoration sites are viewed as potential assets instead of liabilities. The beneficial use of all property has become even more important over the last several years during the base realignment and closure process, in which the missions of many of the DOD installations have increased, yet their ability to increase their physical footprint has been limited due to commercial development immediately outside the installation boundary. Moving on to slide eight. Now the good stuff, the triad stuff. Use of the triad on this project has helped us manage uncertainty, mainly by incorporating the systematic project planning, the dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement techniques that are associated with the triad process. Moving on to slide nine. Seymour Johnson, we utilize the systematic project planning to really refine and develop the conceptual site model from past investigations. We're also able to evaluate the use of real-time analytical techniques to facilitate in-field decisions and incorporate potential remediation approaches into the data collection techniques, all of which save time and money to reduce mobilizations. Again, with our 5-year period of performance, we were very desperate to find ways to compress the schedule, to compress the time from task order award to getting out in the field and actually implementing our remedial solutions. Moving on to slide 10. The dynamic work strategies utilize decision trees, which were really the cornerstone of a work plan or a flexible work plan, which allowed us to iteratively update the conceptual site model to really more effectively characterize the site. All of the sites that we had taken over as part of this contract did have a fair amount of historical investigation data. But as you'll see during my discussion, the reevaluation and refinement of the conceptual site model using the triad really benefited us in achieving our performance objectives. Moving on to slide 11. And finally, the real-time measurement technologies were used, including cone penetrometer testing, laser-induced fluorescence, and rapid optical screening technologies, which allowed us to also transmit data to stakeholders on a daily basis, which resulted in buy-in into our field adjustments to the flexible work plan. Now moving to slide 12. I'd like to now take a few moments to briefly describe these techniques and their characterization and cleanup of two of our sites at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, starting with site OT-29, which is also known as the former radar power site. Now, the site was impacted by a mixed plume of petroleum hydrocarbons, including free product, or L-NAPL, and chlorinated hydrocarbons. The site cleanup activities were fast-tracked after contract award, pending mission-critical hydrant system construction project. We, in effect, had about 12 months, 10 to 12 months to investigate, design, and install our treatment system or install our remedial action approach to allow this this hybrid system construction to proceed on track. Now, there was an original remediation system that was installed at the site in 1998 and consisted of a biosparge, biovent well or series of wells, an extraction trench, and had a projected cleanup of over 2018 or 2020, which obviously the continued operation of that system would not allow us to reach or achieve our cleanup objective by 2010. Moving on to slide 13. I apologize, this slide might be a little bit difficult to read, but it's an overlay of the fuel hydrant system construction plans with the site boundary, which the boundary isn't real well defined, but it's for all intents and purposes in the middle of the slide, and where you you might see a proposed GCA radar label and the arrow, where that arrow is pointing is essentially where site OT-29 is located. It's just south of the some new above-ground storage tanks, and there is an intermittent stream that is located just to the west of the site. Moving on to slide 14. Now, as part of our proposal, our cleanup strategy included site characterization utilizing the triad, removal of residual L-NAPL or free product using surfactant flush and recovery, excavation of grossly contaminated soils, and finally groundwater treatment through in-situ chemical oxidation. Again, all of that anticipated cleanup approach was based on historical data. Now, although the site has been active for multiple years, all stakeholders were in agreement that additional investigation was warranted. TNNA completed this the initial triad-based characterization under a separate contract with the Corps of Engineers. And the figure to the right, lower right, depicts the locations of the investigation data points with red dots, if you can make those out. Now, in June of 05, which is the post-triad investigation, the estimated lateral extent of benzene-impacted groundwater was about 35,000 square feet. And this is about a 50% increase from the extent of impacts indicated by the pre-triad data. Now remember, we were under a performance-based contract with really no ability to request equitable adjustments due to expanded plume dimensions. And, you know, after our initial gulp, we quickly realized the benefit of the additional characterization actions, that if we would have proceeded with our remediation approach based on the data provided during the bidding process, we would have certainly missed a significant portion of the plume and would have really been scratching our heads to try to figure out why we were not meeting our cleanup objectives. So again, this is another very important point about reevaluating and relooking at the conceptual site model, and in this case using the triad process. Moving on to slide 15. During TNNA's triad investigation, they utilized a dynamic work strategy decision tree similar to the decision tree in the slide as a basis for their investigation. It provided the framework for the field crew and the stakeholders to determine when and how the investigation would be expanded or contracted based on the collection of that data and transmittal of this data to the stakeholders on a near real-time basis. Moving on to slide 16. Now, as part of the triad characterization activities, TNNA collected and analyzed over 55 soil and groundwater samples using a geoprobe and membrane interface probe to determine the extent of impacts. They also collected and submitted samples to an off-site fixed-based laboratory to compare that data with the data collected in the field. As I mentioned earlier, based on these data, the extent of the plume was determined to be significantly greater, 50% greater than what was previously thought prior to the letting of the performance-based project. Moving to slide 17. Well, the Bay West team utilized this new data to refine the remedial approach and determine the steps that we thought would be necessary to clean up the site within our five-year period of performance. We initiated the cleanup activities with the injection of about 10,000 gallons of surfactant into areas impacted with free product. And then we subsequently utilized the multi-phase extraction techniques to recover the surfactant and approximately 700 gallons of petroleum product. Again, the use of the triad data was very important. We were able to really target those zones that were previously not thought to contain petroleum impacts or contamination. And the 700 gallons that were recovered in this two-week period really compares favorably to the less than 20 gallons of product recovered during the operation of the legacy treatment system over the previous year. The photographs on the right, the top, just shows the temporary holding tanks for the surfactant solution and distribution manifold for delivering the surfactant to the wells. And then the lower right photo just shows the industrial vacuum truck that was utilized to perform the multi-phase extraction activities. Moving on to slide 18. Following the surfactant injection and recovery activities, we performed a targeted excavation of about 2,000 tons of grossly contaminated soil. Since this radar tower site is underlain by multiple mission-critical communication lines, the use of the triad data was of critical importance for us to determine where we wanted to excavate, because it was clear that we would not be able to go in and do a typical hog and haul operation, even though there weren't a lot of structures on the surface that would prevent that type of action. And, you know, one of the lessons that we learned during the excavation is to not lose sight of the importance of site stratigraphic data. During the excavation, we encountered a discontinuous 2 to 6 inch thick lens of a discolored, highly contaminated soil on the southeastern portion of the site. And this is one of the reasons on the next site that I'll be discussing that we incorporated the use of cone penetrometer data to allow us to evaluate the stratigraphy. And it's very important to look at your sampling interval as well, because that certainly, I think if we had a different sample interval, we may have encountered that thin layer, and that probably would have changed the path for us in terms of how we went about doing the excavation work. Nonetheless, the excavation activities were very successful, and the triad was an important key to allowing us to target our work without disrupting the Air Force's activities. Moving on to slide 19. As I mentioned, the extents of soil and groundwater impacts were greater than anticipated during the bidding phase, and the tenets of performance-based contracting is to allow the contractor the flexibility to develop alternative methods to expedite the project, as well as, in theory, save some dollars if they can. And we're able to use the triad data to segregate the grossly contaminated soil from the less impacted soil for treatment in an on-site biopile. Initially, we had just anticipated submitting all of, transporting all of our soil off to a local landfill. And as we collected the data, realized that, and as we looked at the extent of impacts being significantly greater than anticipated, we were able to develop, and SAIC deserves a lot of credit for this, an alternate technique for treating the soil on site. Therefore, we not only achieved the beneficial reuse of the treated material as we performed the treatment over a 10-month period, but we also saved significant funds by avoiding off-site disposal fees for several thousand tons. And the graph on the right, or the table on the right, just depicts the concentrations in the soil after excavation in January of 2005 and after the period of biopile operation. And all but for one constituent or series of all fat aromatic hydrocarbons, we would have met even unrestricted use criteria. So again, a very successful operation as far as we were concerned. Moving on to slide 20. Lastly, we utilized the triad data to focus our in-situ chemical oxidation activities, which were conducted over three events. And I apologize, perhaps those of you who downloaded the PowerPoint version of the presentation would see the animation, but what you're seeing on the screen and the right-hand side is the location with the circles and the dots of the last round of injection, ISCO injection of points. And we were really able to contract the number of injection points from the first series of ISCO injections to the third based on the success of the treatment and based on our ability to really target those zones by utilizing the triad data. So when it was all said and done, we treated initially about a 50,000 square foot area and have achieved over a 90% reduction in site-based chemicals of concern through the three ISCO events. The graph on the lower left just depicts one of the constituents and the reduction of concentrations from the prior to the first ISCO event in April of 2005 and after the third ISCO event in May of 2006. Moving on to slide 22. Slide 21. My apologies. To summarize, for OT-29, starting with the triad data collected by TNNA, we were able to complete site remediation activities with no impact to the mission-critical fuel hydrant system construction. We received NC DENR concurrence on no further active remediation status, and we were able to complete the cleanup in about 4 years, which was a significant reduction from the projected cleanup time frame with the legacy system. And based on the government's estimate, we were able to save in excess of $1.5 million. Again, I don't say that as to, you know, look what Bay West or the Bay West team did. It's really a testament to the use of the triad to reevaluate the conceptual site model and to incorporate those results during the design and remediation process. Moving to slide 22. The second site I would like to briefly discuss is the bulk fuel storage area, or BFSA. The BFSA is actually comprised of four separate IRP sites impacted by a 400,000-gallon jet fuel release. The site did have a legacy treatment system that was designed and installed in 1998, and it consisted of several groundwater and product recovery wells. Moving to slide 23. Now, during our proposal preparation, the BFSA cleanup strategy included the optimization of the legacy treatment system for about a year prior to receiving funding to perform the site remedial action activities. And another significant element of the cleanup strategy was the characterization of the site and reevaluation of the site model using the triad and finally the design, installation, and operation of an enhanced recovery system, which we thought would be necessary to achieve the performance objectives. Moving to slide 24. Now, much like OT-29, our BFSA triad characterization utilized systematic project planning, including a decision tree, similar to the previous slide shown for OT-29, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement techniques, including the use of rapid optical screening tool for simultaneous collection of laser-induced fluorescence and cone penetrometer data. In this effort, we were able to complete 98 borings over a 9-day field effort with virtually no impact to the Air Force mission in this fairly busy portion of the site. Moving to slide 25. This is just a couple of photos showing the geoprobe and the lift and cone penetrometer activities. In the upper right photograph, you may be able to make out the optical eye that was utilized for the lift analyses. And the lower right is some of the on-site analytical gear that was also able to be utilized to download this information so we could transmit it to our stakeholders on, if not the night after the investigation, certainly the following morning. Moving on to slide 26. This slide just depicts a couple of screenshots of the data that were collected at the BFSA. The graphic to the right shows the laser-induced fluorescence data with respect to depth. Typically, we completed these geoprobe borings to around 18 to 20 feet. Depth of groundwater was typically around 10 to 12 feet. And the purpose of this investigation really was to target those areas that we believed would be impacted or may be impacted with free floating product. Under the NC Diener UST rules, one of the main criteria for us to achieve our performance objective of site closure is to remove residual free phase product or LNAPL. Because we had collected data earlier and also during this triad characterization that showed that the groundwater concentrations were below their gross contaminant levels and the soil impacts were also below the regulatory criteria. So once we were able to, we figured to target the mobile free-phase product, that would send us a significant way down the path to site closure. The graphic on the left, perhaps you can make out on some of the squiggly lines on the left-hand portions of those boring columns. That is the cone penetrometer data that really provided some useful information as to the stratigraphy, especially as it was related to where we were seeing free-floating product and the product smear zone. Moving on to slide 27. So we were able to use this triad data to update the conceptual site model. And so, you know, really what does this mean? Well, the lines in blue, where the blue line shows the estimated pre-triad extent of free product or LNAPL. And based on our triad characterization, the purplish color area is the estimated post-triad extent of free product or LNAPL. And as you can see, if we would have based our remedial approach on historical data, and if we would not have reevaluated the conceptual site model, we would have been targeting areas with little contamination and certainly missed areas with significant contamination, again, resulting in probably a year or two down the road us scratching our heads and trying to figure out why we're struggling to meet our performance objective on schedule. Moving on to slide 28. So we utilized this data to design a multi-phase extraction system, which consists of 65 wells within the free product zones identified during the triad investigation. Plume did have a fairly significant footprint as a result of our work. We also had to install over 3,000 linear feet of piping, and we had to be creative with where we placed that piping due to some of the site activities. Again, the use of the triad data allowed us to be a little bit more effective in targeting these areas and designing where our distribution system would be placed. And lastly, we upgraded the system, as I indicated, with a fairly substantial extraction system to increase the recovery volume, as estimated by the triad data and some of the 3D modeling that we performed. Moving on to slide 29. A very important element of our triad characterization was to evaluate the extent of the smear zone, because we were going to go in and place multi-phase extraction system. We wanted to have an idea of obviously not only where to set the screens for our extraction wells, but also where would be the optimal placement for our extraction stingers, for lack of a better word, or pipes. And although the legacy remediation system did have some capabilities in the adjustment of the drop tubes, they were working blind because they didn't have the data that we were able to collect during the triad, indicating the extent of not only the free phase and free mobile phase, but also the smear zone. And we typically adjust these points and the drop tubes on if not a daily basis, a weekly basis. Moving on to slide 30. Just a couple of photos of a drop tube being placed in the extraction well and one of the manifolds associated with the extraction piping. Moving on to slide 31. Based on the triad data, we decided to configure our new treatment system into five distinct treatment zones, which could be rotated and or adjusted or pulsed based on site conditions and recovery rates. And the extraction of activities as of today typically range in the removal of about anywhere from 200 to 300 SCFM of air, as well as about 20 to 30 gallons per minute of water throughout all of these zones or the zones that are in operation. Moving on to slide 32. The slide shows the outside of our multi-phase extraction enclosure. A key component of this system was the small footprint of the enclosure. Since again, land is at a premium at this installation, in particular at this bulk fuels storage area location. Also, its portability is going to be a real plus in that we, once we achieve our performance objective, we'll quickly be able to remove the system or move the system off site without any significant demolition activities. Moving on to slide 33. So following the installation of the new system, we have removed the equivalent of over 50,000 gallons of petroleum product in a 12-month period. This compares pretty favorably to the less than, I think, 2,000 gallons that were removed in the previous 12 months with the legacy system. We estimate that the cleanup time frame will reduce from more than 10 years to about 4.5 years. And as depicted in this figure, we have reduced the average product thickness. And this figure is a little bit dated, but at the time of this figure, from 5 to 9 inches during a legacy treatment system operation to less than 1/10 of an inch with the new triad-based remediation approach, or triad-targeted, really, remediation approach. As of this month, there is only one well that has free-phase product remaining in the well, and that's at a thickness of less than 1/10 of an inch, or 1/10 of a foot. So, again, the message is, always take a look at the conceptual site model, look at ways to refine it, and in our case, at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, the use of the triad approach allowed us to do it very quickly. on the Flight 34. So to summarize, as I mentioned earlier, the triad reduced for us the number of mobilizations and certainly the fixed base lab costs. It also reduced the field and reporting efforts, and probably most important, it allowed us to get into the field and start designing and installing and operating our remediation systems probably anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half faster than what we may have experienced if we used the conventional investigation approach. I appreciate your time today. I'd be happy to take any questions on slide 35. My contact information is listed there, as well as, I believe, an abstract summary. Again, thank you very much for your time.
Well, we'll give it one more second because those streaming in can't speak through the phone. They can submit a question online. Those on the phone line, of course, you can unmute the phone and ask a question. However, you know, as slide 35 shows, if there is also additional questions, you can contact Marty directly after this. So with that, are there any questions specific to this presentation?
Hello, hello, Martin. This is Dan Lombardi. Two quick questions. One, the bulk storage facility, what was the summary of the geology at that location? And regarding the El Napo thickness, if there was any heterogeneity and you lowered the water level, did the regulators have you look at something other than El Napo thickness, which could be an apparent thickness? Did you do any bail down testing to determine recovery rates or recharge of the El Napo after you, you know, did some time of your remediation?
Well, Dan, was it Dean, was that your name?
I'm sorry.
Thank you for the question. To answer your first question with respect to the, at the BFSA, the free phase product, certainly what we were gauging, in most cases is the apparent thickness. Most of those measurements that I referenced were not after any specific bail down tests. We did perform some bail down tests within selected wells, and as you would expect, the actual thickness or the recovery rate into the wells was a fraction. You know, maybe it was 60% or so. I'm going from memory of what we had seen with the apparent product thickness. You know, without doing any bail test. With respect to the site stratigraphy or geology, there was some heterogeneity within the stratigraphy. In particular, as we moved to the north of the site, I believe the soil types became a little bit higher silt content, but generally they were a silty sand with a couple of small gravelly seams. And certainly the actual thickness in those stratigraphic settings is going to vary it a little bit from what the apparent product thickness might suggest.
Were those zones higher than the lowered water level from the multi-phase extraction wells?
They were generally a little bit lower.
Okay.
But also Seymour Johnson, or that neck of the woods, had about a year ago, had somewhat of a dry spell, so the water table had been somewhat depressed, mm-hmm. which was useful for us, especially looking at the multi-phase extraction activities. One thing to point out, we did when we did collect the measurements of the apparent product thickness, that was after the system was what I would say static. In other words, we had turned the system off and allowed conditions to get relatively close to static, if not at static, after anywhere from a 2 to 4 day period with shutting the system operations off. Sometimes we would wait even 5 to 8 days.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, again, I would just also like to emphasize one more time, it's You know, as I talk through these slides, it's not, I don't want this to come off as this is what Bay West or the Bay West team did. It's really reiterating the value of taking another look at the conceptual site model, especially as you have sites that, in this case, had been investigated several years ago, perhaps when there weren't the available technologies that we have today, and certainly like the BFSA site conditions through the legacy treatment system operations have certainly changed the orientation and the extent of impacts. So that's even more critical, in my mind, and a very important reason to reevaluate the sites.
And Marty, that's probably a good segue. You know, in short, you know, Marty's case study shows probably what's better described as remedial design optimization, utilizing an evolving conceptual site model to refine and complete the remedial design more effectively. The next presentation, with no more questions, at least currently, and we can always come back at the end. The next presentation, as previously mentioned, is going to be from Mr. Jim Wolfe from Tetra Tech. Jim is a senior hydrogeologist with Tetra Tech and a registered geologist in the state of California. Jim has 20 years of professional experience consulting for a wide range of federal, state, and private clients, primarily in the areas of modeling and visualization of hazardous waste sites and the investigation and remediation of petroleum and chlorinated solvent plumes. He has used many of the decision support tools, DSTs, featured on the Clumen website, and in this case, in particular, he's going to be talking about one of those tools, Spatial and Analyst and Decision Assistance, SADA. And Jim is going to be talking about the use of this tool during a remedial action. So with that, I turn everybody to slide 36, which will be Jim's first slide. And Jim, I turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Nick. Can you hear me? Hello?
I'm clear.
I'm clear? Okay. Well, thanks for the intro. I'll get right to it so we can not waste any time. As Nick said, primarily a hydrogeologist, but I work a lot with visualization, and this project was a little different than I'm used to. It was a soil removal action. It had nothing to do with groundwater. But anyway, I've been working on the triad approach, working with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technological Innovation for about 8 to 10 years. On a number of sites, I've implemented it as a principal scientist on one of my own sites here in California, where I'm at right now, and I've consulted on many sites where they've been implementing a particular tool or a process. And this is one particular tool I've used on several sites working with OSRTI, and it's Spatial Analyst and Decision Assistance. And moving on to the next slide, slide 37? Yeah. What I want to show is how a decision support tool can be used to integrate the elements of the triad. And if you're unfamiliar with the term, DST or decision support tool is a interactive software program that decision makers can use to, you know, ask questions, to model your site, to help with the conceptual site model, similar to, you know, what Marty was talking about earlier, and base your decisions that you make and be able to back them up and support them using it. In this particular instance, we used it to guide removal action, and kind of a real important part of the whole process that I probably didn't really see coming as I got involved was how important it was to provide visualizations to the different stakeholders as we went through the process to help everybody come to consensus, which, of course, is an important component of systematic planning. Okay, move to slide 38. The Barker Chemical Company Superfund site, I don't believe it's ever been listed on the NPL. It was handled through EPA Region 4 Superfund branch. And at the, this project had gone for some time. It's a large former manufacturing area that turned residential, probably developed in the 1960s, judging by some of the photos. And there are two areas, which both one residential, one kind of mixed residential open space. The residential area is called Garden Mall Court. And the other area, the roadbed that extended 4 or 5 miles to the northeast, was called Former Inglis Road. And that goes through larger residential lots, open space, even a hunting preserve. Okay, on to the next slide, please. Here's a map showing the locations of the two sites relative to each other. This is in Florida. You can kind of see from the little inset map on the right. Almost up to the panhandle, pretty sparsely populated area, but it's 7 miles from the coast up this, really it's a river, maybe like a large creek, that they used to actually ship the products down. But you can see in Garden Mall Court, you can see that the black lines indicate the parcel boundaries, and there's some large parcels of 1.5 to 2 acres in the center, and some of those smaller ones are 0.2 acre large. On to the next slide, please. A little bit of background about the site. Fertilizer manufacturing. In order, as part of the process, the manufacturing process, they had to use large quantities of sulfuric acid, and they shipped over pyrite ore from Spain to, and they would roast it to generate this, the acid. And the waste product was these pyrite cinders that were high in arsenic and lead. Which then they used as roadbed material, pretty, you know, typical kind of practice in the mid 20th century, and even vegetation control, which I guess gives you some indication of perhaps the toxic properties of the soil. On to the next slide, please. Here's a couple snapshots of the soil, the soil that had been spread out from the site. It was stained red. At both locations, the Inglis Road location and Garden Mall Court, you know, in the Inglis Road picture, you can see it very well, but being Florida and kind of rural, in most places the vegetation was a little more tangled, but it would go right through people's, some places where you could see it best were in people's yards, where they'd mowed it and everything. And then the lower picture shows Garden Mall Court with a kids plastic ATV there in the background for dramatic effect. Okay, on to the next slide, please. You know, if all you had to do was map out red soil on the surface, you probably wouldn't need very sophisticated visualization tools or a very sophisticated sampling program. But often it was buried, particularly where there was topsoil, as in the lower photo there in the Garden Mall Court area. Okay, on to the next slide, please. This map is a GIS map that kind of shows the status of the project about the time I started. And the purple and green shaded areas, there had been, the purple had been a very old removal action and the green shaded area a more recent one. When I came onto the project, the red diagonal line areas were being studied, and eventually we moved into the pale yellow, many of the parcels there. This was a voluntary action on the part of the landowners. If you did not want to participate, you didn't have to. You just signed something saying EPA informed me that I could have you know, these samples taken and the soils removed, and I declined. They had, I don't know if they had done this in earlier iterations. I mean, you can see that there was at least, this was the third removal, which indicates a problem. I think people have been coming on board piecemeal and participating in this, and this whole project threatened to kind of go on forever, quite frankly. And so the EPA had a real interest in doing a final comprehensive action. It's important to note the three main regulatory stakeholders at this point. On one hand, you have the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. They were interested in really as total a site cleanup as could be had without, you know, disturbing or upsetting any of the people, the residents there. They also had developed what I think is considered a fairly low remedial action target for arsenic of 8 milligrams per kilogram. Meanwhile, with the EPA Superfund branch, they had brought in emergency response on the two previous occasions to conduct the time-critical removal actions. And once again, I think they were able to secure some funding through emergency response. And I think they probably came in with the caveat that, you know, we're only going to prioritize sites where we're doing removals based on our time-critical removal action level of 40 milligrams per kilogram. So this kind of contradiction, this set up some conflict, some differing viewpoints that I think caused the EPA RPM at this point to look about for new tools to help bring people together and also to plan the final phases of sampling and removal. And that's where SEDA, next slide please, that's where SEDA came into the picture. As it turned out, early on in the process, I was able to download, one of the features of SEDA is it's pretty easy to bring in shape files, DXF, drawings, and the data, and we'll get to that. I'll discuss that in the next slide a little bit more. But bring in some of the sampling data and immediately begin displaying, within hours, you're displaying posted data values, you're selecting analytes of interest. They have a kind of a report format in SEDA you can export things. My preference was just to basically copy the screenshots out onto PowerPoint because I kind of worked best that way. But really within, you know, every time there would be a meeting to discuss anything, I could spend a half hour to an hour before the meeting, you know, presenting different types of sampling plans. How would we, if we do, for instance, the Florida's Department of Environmental Protection plan and go by their regulations, you know, their very strict regulations, the word would be prescriptive. What would it look like? How many samples were we talking about? And I generated a lot of visualizations early on. So in that sense, it was important in systematic planning. And then as we'll see, really it became the most important analysis tool when we got around to planning the actual and conducting the removal action. I should also note that at the same time, it was kind of a two-pronged approach. She also brought in another member of Tetra Tech, who is a statistician, and a lot of the some of the problems had to be resolved through classical statistical analyses, and we'll also talk about that very briefly because that's not the thrust of my talk today, nor am I an expert in that. Some of the advantages of SEDA. Next slide, please.
Hey, Jim. Jim.
Yes.
Slide 45. Some of the listeners are having a hard time following which slide you're on.
Slide 45.
Slide 45, and then going forward, if you could just go from there.
Okay, yeah, I'll use the slider bar more. It's a little hard to see the number until you slide it up and down. So I apologize. This slide 45 is a screenshot of the SEDA homepage, and I just wanted to point out here some of the advantages of SEDA. Of course, the cost is free. There is pretty good technical support for freeware. The folks at University of Tennessee are usually managed to respond. There is a users group, online users group, that anybody who is working with SEDA should join. And you can email Robert Stewart, who's the developer. And if he's in the country, which is most of the time, but he occasionally leaves to do a seminar, he will get back to you within a day. And with a very specific answer, usually. And what I also wanted to mention about SEDA is it's focused on some really specific technical areas. And whereas the graphics and the visualization by no means are as sophisticated as something you might see with EVS or Earth Vision or one of those, it's very well targeted at developing different sampling designs. There's ways to develop both initial and secondary sampling designs. Risk assessment, especially ecological risk assessment, is probably the foremost tool for geostatistics. You can do variogram analysis in SEDA. In this area, MARSIM, which I pointed out, that's really more of a Nuclear Regulatory Commission approach to doing a radiological survey, which, of course, is very much a real-time type of survey. So you can see that they've really made an effort to incorporate TRIAD and shape their tool to support TRIAD-type projects. Okay, now I'm advancing to slide 46. When I say it's easy to use, you can be up and running with data fairly quickly, within hours, if you have your data in an Excel format and you can export it as a comma delimited file. What happens, you can go to the menu in SATA and import data, and this this tool will pop up these dialog boxes, which will give you an opportunity to match your column headings to the things that SATA needs, the data fields that SATA requires. You can see the upper four are required, and there's a pick list button at the right of each one. And so you can select, you need to select the name of the analyte or whatever it is, a chemical you're displaying, the values, the easting and northing, and that's all you need for a two-dimensional analysis. Now, if you go to three dimensions, you need a Z point, and please note that it's a midpoint. So that's one thing you might have to change in your input data. You might have to go from an interval to a midpoint, but that can be done fairly easily in Excel. And then there's other information. The detection qualifier, it's important to note that it's a binary qualifier system where it wants a zero if it's a non-detect, or it wants you to flag detections with one. And, we usually look at qualifiers as alphabetic codes. And, SATA wants as this number, it's easy for it to, and there's a lot of analyses when you're plotting your data, when you are contouring or interpolating your data, you have non-detects mixed in, and you have to make the decision on, do I want to take half the detection limit, or assign the full detection limit, or assign zero. And there are, in the modules where you build your contouring algorithm, you can, there's dialog boxes where you select that. And finally, there's media and sample date, and that's a way to kind of subset your data. So you can bring in a big database and only display and only analyze on a certain sample date or sample date range. On the right side, the two right side boxes show what happened if in this module where you load the data, there's a problem. The upper box is the error message, and what I really quite frankly love about that is that it the error message also brings up this screen where it flags what it doesn't like. And, I'm so used to other softwares where about as much as you ever find out is you just had a floating point error or something else like that. Well, here you can go right to the column or even the cells. You can scroll through your input data screen and look for cells that sometimes it's a cell that's flagged red. So it makes it a lot easier to troubleshoot your data. So anyways, at this site, I've advanced to slide 47. At this site, we really had two key issues that deal with arsenic and lead. And the big problem is the real-time tool that we're using out in the field here was the XRS. And those of you who got onto the XRS seminars last August probably heard something about interferences between arsenic and lead. It's very difficult to see the arsenic response because it's masked by the lead response. The result is your detection limits are increased pretty much automatically by the Innovax or the two different XRF makers give you output, automatically calculate detection limits based on some sort of internal statistics. And so what we were finding is we rarely were able to detect arsenic below 30 milligrams per kilogram. And is that a problem? Yes, it's definitely a problem. Not so much when you're looking at the US EPA's time critical action level of 40 milligrams per kilogram, but the Florida action level was 8. And so once again, this problem comes into play. This slide number 48 just shows the low rate of detection on the left column, the XRF data, and on the right side is laboratory for arsenic and lead. And you can see we had a 2% detection rate in the field with XRF for arsenic, which normally you would think, well, that just shuts down this tool for being used in this way. Fortunately, we did send off with the XRF. It's not a destructive technique, so you can analyze samples in the field and then send them to a laboratory for a bench-mounted instrument. And we had many samples sent off, and they were able to develop a relationship between the laboratory-analyzed arsenic concentrations, which had a detection rate of almost 60%, and the lead concentrations detected in the field with XRF. So we used that relationship. That was one of the things the statistician did. He was able to develop the regression equation with a correlation coefficient above 0.9. That was acceptable to everyone. So what we did with that is, I'll show you on the next slide, if we advance to slide 49, we discussed different approaches for solving this problem of the arsenic detection limits. And under option two, I phrased it there as synthesizing the arsenic data set. Well, I was basically embedding a regression equation into my input spreadsheet and then bringing it into SATA. And I had a column with the original data, which I called arsenic raw, and then I had a column with arsenic concentration, so I could toggle back and forth and display, here's what the original arsenic concentrations look like, and of course they're mostly non-detect, and here is, you know, our arsenic concentrations that were derived from the lead to arsenic regression equation. The other solutions, really, one was to use a random number generator, which some people actually favored, even in spite of the fact that there was only 2% detection. The next slide will show kind of the effect of that. Option three was to merge these two, because even if you prefer the regression equation, when lead is non-detect, you still have to generate a value. So, and it's usually low detection anyway, or non-detection, so those generally aren't an issue, but you still have to take care of it. You have to find a way to display this data and account for it. And option four was not really realistic. That was the state's preferred option, but the cost of taking the number of samples they wanted to delineate the arsenic hotspots in the soil were quite prohibitive if you're sending them all off to a laboratory. Okay, advance to slide 40. This one's coming up slowly. Slide 50. Here's some SATA graphics, and they might not bowl you over, but the polygons or the squares in the background are some of those parcel lines. So that's what we needed to see, delineating which parcels it's crossing. The heavy long rectangle was actually how we delineated the former Inglis Road and this 50 feet off on either side, like an easement on that. So the little bullets are samples. And we have three colors. Unfortunately, I don't have a legend on this slide, but we'll see one soon. And what I did was, in SATA allows you to, the user can define their own legend. So in this case, I selected three categories. 40 and above, which was colored red. 8 and below, which was colored blue. And yellow was everything in between. So the blue areas were the areas that, according to the Florida criteria, were clean. We didn't have to worry about. The red areas were the areas that, according to the EPA, time-critical removal action, were dirty and had to be removed. You can see, although there are point values above the EPA's limit, they're always surrounded by lower values. So the background coloration is really the result of an interpolation program, which we'll discuss real quickly here in a minute. But this kind of display was kind of bringing everybody together to see the random number generation had some inherent difficulties. Basically, that every time you bring in and generate random, every time you open up Excel file and load it to SATA, it populates it with new random numbers. So that's why this blue area shifted around so much. Okay, please advance to slide number 51. SATA also allows for each one of those areas, you can calculate the area or the volume if you're working in three dimensions.
of the soil or the material in cubic feet that exceed certain thresholds. And on that previous example, you know, it basically, under the F Florida criterion, each option, the random, the regression equation, the combination, came up with very different volumes that had to be removed. Whereas nothing exceeded EPA's threshold on either one. So this part was a little bit more of a concern of Florida. And even though the option one comes up with the greatest volume, and usually that's comforting, or that, I don't want to say that comfort, it usually, the regulatory agencies, my experience is they prefer the most conservative approach. And certainly that is by the numbers alone, but with the visualizations I was able to show them, we all came to a consensus that the random number generation just was not to be, did not provide a solid basis for designating areas to be removed. Please advance to slide 52. So the compromise that was worked out to balance the needs and expectations of Florida on one hand and the emergency response people on the other hand was that EPA would only conduct removals where samples indicated that we were above the time critical removal action level of 40. But once we go into a parcel and begin excavation, we will excavate to the limits of the area that is contoured or interpolated to be above 8. So that was a workable solution for both parties. And we'd also provide all of our output to Florida, so if they decided to pursue other parcels that exceeded their limit but not EPA's, they could do so. They'd have the visualizations to work from. I should also mention, point out, and this will become important in the next slide, that in the upper bullet it mentions composite samples. Advance, please, to slide 53. This was an issue, it often is, discrete samples versus composite. Florida people, their prescriptive regulation said we need to use discrete samples, and they specified a rate which was pretty high. And as I said, it just was not money to do that from EPA's standpoint. So we were able to look at, do two things. From the statistical end, do some calculations of an action level based on submitting a composite and the discrete aliquots to a lab and getting the concentrations from the discrete samples and comparing to the composite of what concentration, what limit can we use with a composite sample that we feel 95% confident that will capture any exceedances of the discrete samples, the mean of the discrete samples, excuse me. And that was the statistician's part of it. What I was able to do is produce some visualizations that help, show people what the results are, what the effects are of this. On this one, it's probably very hard to see, and I'm sorry about that. But you can see up in the upper north corner of that site, there are five. You can kind of see a hot spot in that quadrant, and I think this one was divided into sub-quadrants and analyzed, meaning you could remove one quadrant or another, because it was a large parcel. But the composite also came up very high there. And so where the composite was saying dig and remove the discrete samples and vice versa, and that helped build confidence in the composite sample approach to determine which parcels to remove. Once again, the delineation once you're in was done using discrete samples in the field. In fact, by collecting confirmation sampling, which was submitted to the lab. Once we wrestled with all these decisions, decided how this was going to go forth, how each data stream was going to be treated in a collaborative sense and how they're related to each other, I was able to give then my project manager an estimate of how much time it would take for me to go through each and every parcel and do all the analyses that were required, which was very important because you can imagine this was a very tight budget. So the three types of maps I created, one was a map to post the data, which is the center of the largest one, and you get the value posted there. That's the actual, those are for the composite samples, but you can see that the, there's a more dense sample network in the two other maps, and those were showing discrete, because once this first map was evaluating, we said, oh, we are over, and please look at the legend. It's not 40, it's now 22.2, because when I'm looking at a composite sample, I used a different legend that was geared to that. And then the next step was to contour the data, which is interpolate is really a better way to put it. And that's where you lay a grid over your site. You have scattered data, and the object of the interpolation is to provide a regular grid of estimates based on this very scattered, and usually an environmental work, it's kind of a clustered data set. And you can use various approaches, the very sophisticated approaches in, say, the ArcGIS statistical. However, usually in a soil site, most of the time can't really support a geostatistical approach because it's not always a regular kind of shape like a groundwater plume is. It can often be very random. And so use something like inverse distance weighted, which is much less time consuming, and just simply every place there is a node in your grid, you tell the algorithm, how far out do I want to throw a net to capture data in order to estimate the concentration at this point? That's one parameter you give it. You also give it the weighting, whether you're squaring the distance or cubing at the inverse of the distance, and you weight them accordingly. So the closest samples get much greater weight than farther samples away. That's kind of a good intuitive approach to this, and it was worked very well at the site. The third map on the right is what's called an area of concern map, and this is a very simple. Once you have done the contouring, the interpolation, it's just one simple step in SEDA to then give it an action level and then say, I want you to show me everything, shade everything that's over this action level. And that will be the area I have to remove. And what you also get is, if you're doing it in three dimensions, you'll get the estimated removal volume, which is another piece of data that I gave. I calculated for every single parcel, and I did it for every level, for what's above 40 milligrams per kilogram, what is above 8, and even a couple intermediate levels that DPA requested. They want to know what's above 20, what's above 30. So I could give them all of that information. And unlike that earlier graphic from the former Inglis Road, there were many, as you can see on the left, there were many parcels in Garden Mall Court that exceeded EPA's removal criterion too. Actually, there were some on the former Inglis Road too, just not the one that we had highlighted. So please advance to slide 55. Another advantage of having a decision support tool that you can generate graphics fairly rapidly is you can demonstrate to people. I don't like to work in a black box, and I don't think people like it when they can't see what you're doing. So when I was going to change an important parameter in this algorithm that interpolates the data and gives you these maps, I would show, well, here's the effect of a certain search radius. On the left, what I generally used for most parcels was a 50-foot search radius, meaning for every little square, and I used a 5-foot by 5-foot grid. So if you could see that grid, it would be almost like a very fine fishnet over that site. So for every point in the middle of that, for every cell in that grid, it would look out 50 feet, and you can see there's large areas that are not colored in the center of the site because there simply was not enough data nearby. You can also set a parameter saying how many data points do you need, and I used 2. So I said, hey, I only want to estimate a value where there is at least 2 values within 50 feet. And so on the right, you can see this one, it was justified using an 80-foot search radius. That worked much better. But I wanted to show them, hey, I'm going out of my normal protocol here. Here's why. And it's very visual, and you can see it easily. So to move on to the next slide, which is slide 56, you can see that sometimes at this parcel, it was very clear-cut. The area to be removed graded sharply from the street side to the riverside. It looks a little conservative on this AOC map. The advantage is you can see the posted values, and you can see clearly see what SATA was telling us was above the level we want to excavate. So it was a little conservative, but I think for the most part, the field team found that going with a somewhat conservative path the first time meant a lot less going back and additional sampling beyond the first pass. Please advance to slide number 57. This is a visual representation that wasn't done in SATA. This was actually exported to a GIS. This was a shapefile created. And on the bullets on the right, you know, we talk about how these were developed in SATA, but I had to export them using a utility that SATA had at the time to generate basically an Excel file of integers representing either the areas that were above or below. And then to create the shapefiles, we had to have a third party, the GIS crew, do it. And why I bolded that one comment at the bottom, because the new SATA 5.0 cuts out the middleman. So it makes the whole process more efficient than it was when I did this. So this is what the shapefile looked like. The GIS people processed this and exported to the folks walking around with a Trimble. They exported the boundary lines. So they gave them polyline shapefile. And that was loaded onto the Trimble, and on the screen you could actually see the polyline in front of you. And this enabled the field crew to flag and mark those lines. And then they'd come in with equipment and excavate it out. Please move to slide 58. This shows that parcel again, and this is to illustrate this legacy data, beware of it. As I said, the GIS mapping that was done previously was pretty rough cut, and here you see the parcel on the left, the way it was portrayed to us, that much of it had been removed there in the green hatching. Well, on the right, you see the shaded area was what was actually removed based on those SATA maps I generated. The text and the dots are the confirmation sample locations, and so it turned out that half of the area excavated probably. If you had relied on the legacy maps, you wouldn't think you would have to, and you would have left it behind. So please advance to slide 59. So the result of the confirmation sampling was very positive. They were collected at the rate of one every 250 square feet. Only a few confirmation samples exceeded the 40 milligram per kilogram limit for arsenic, and even less for lead. And to my knowledge, those samples, many, if not all of the four of them, I think all of them, were constrained. We had that result because we had hit bedrock, which was pretty shallow at the site. It was just constrained by the bedrock contact. So please advance to the next slide. So the summary of the effort was we did SATA analyses on 42 parcels split between the Garden Mall Court, and the former Inglis Road. I created this PowerPoint file with the data post maps, the interpolated maps, the area of concern maps, and an Excel spreadsheet that we gave to the GIS folks with the clean and dirty array, plus the numerical estimates of a table showing how many cubic feet you'd have to remove for each of those thresholds. It took me an average of 90 minutes to do it for each parcel, which was very important, again, to the project manager. She could predict, and she knew exactly what I was going to do. And they eventually conducted removal actions on 17 of the 42 parcels. I think the field effort was about 4 or 5 months. So advance, please, to slide 61. The bottom line is the ATSDR public health assessment says that now that the removal has been conducted, there's no apparent public health hazard. It's been mitigated. I think the EPA is under the process of trying to close out and cut their, hand the site over to Florida and say, we're done with this. We've got the third party to come in and verify that. And that was in May of 2008. So finally, advance to additional information, the contact information. If you would like to find out more about how SATA was applied or you have a similar project where you're thinking of doing this type of analysis, you can contact me to get my experiences. I'd be happy to share them with you. For the expert, please, the true expert, go to the SATA website and sign up for that user support group, and then you can ask Robert Stewart himself, and he's very helpful. You can also get the Barker case study by following this link, and there is a FRTR website, a Decision Support Tool Matrix, which is a very good site. When I went in last week, the link to this one case study was broken somehow, and I think they're working on it, and it'd be great if they could get that link back up. In the meantime, this link goes to someplace on the Internet where, it still does exist, and you can download it. And finally, the ATSDR PEDBook health assessment link is at the bottom. So it advances to slide number 63, and I'll ask if there are any questions.
Hey, Jim, this is Nick. If you go to slide 54, where you're showing the three different maps created using SCADA.
Correct.
And just take the one on the left, using the inverse distance weighted interpolation map.
Mm-hmm.
What would a user need to create that map? I understood you to say that you did not use any GIS package for this. You obviously have a base map. I mean, what is the specific output from the SCADA tool, and then how did you use it to create this map?
Okay, well, the inputs were the database, which was Excel files. That's the sample information. The thin gray lines are a GIS coverage, a polyline coverage that you import. You can either import a GIS coverage or a DXF. Not really sophisticated graphics when you bring them in, but it did the trick for us, certainly. The heavy black line is that you actually draw in SCADA. They give you drawing tools to kind of drag and click, create your own polylines, tie them off, and you've created this rectangle. You can save them, and they're always there. You go down, pick list them, parcel number 129 or whatever, and that heavy line will come up, and you'll see that above that next property up, there's just empty bullets, and it just excludes. That shows you, okay, we're not going to use these data. Although I do want to add this caveat, it does actually use those data in a sense. It's not displaying them, but in accordance with what you select on your search radius, if it loops out and catches some of those data in the adjacent property, it will use them. But the module that you go through to set this up, this mapping thing, you have to select about four parameters. So it's pretty easy, and it's fast. So you can see the effects of your parameter, go back and decide, I want a finer grid, I want a coarser grid, I want a greater search radius, a lesser search radius, a greater number of points, fewer data, the data minimum and maximum can be changed. So you have all those controls just for inverse distance weighted. And there's a couple more simple algorithms, and as I said, there's geostatistics at the other end, which is somewhat more complex.
So you basically, if you didn't have necessarily a GIS import drawing, you could use the drawing tool within SCADA to draw a very basic.
You don't need any kind of drawing. Actually, you can import that Excel file, and you will get a little space to work with, showing all your points in relation to each other in two-dimensional space. And then you can draw around it using the drawing tool. You can also bring in a DXF CAD file, too.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, it's nice to have a base map, but it's not absolutely necessary. Okay, are there any other questions?
There was one submitted on, also on slide, well, not also, switching to slide 56.
Uh-huh.
Someone from California states, you know, there's one data point greater than 8 ppm outside the AOC area.
Okay. There's one greater than 8 outside of the AOC, which, outside of the red shaded area. There's one greater than 8. Okay. I see it. 8.68. down there. Yes, depending on how much smoothing you do, you increase the chance that the this particular algorithm, the inverse distance weighted, does not, it's not one that's built to absolutely positively honor every single point. There are algorithms, I think there's one in SATA that does that. I would have to double check on that. What you do get is you see the display, and really in SATA a lot of the tools are kind of focused towards risk assessment. So a lot of times in risk assessment, you know, you're really averaging over an area. So yeah, if you have a bright line criteria, it might fall outside using this particular algorithm, the area that says dig. The good thing is you can display it and show everybody, and, you know, if people have a problem with it, you might want to switch algorithms. You might want to switch approaches. If people don't, or you can maybe just go out and flag that spot. You could probably, you could select it as a point, export it, and load that in as a point shape file. I think the important thing is being able to see it and not having a black box.
Okay, hopefully that answers your question in California. Are there anybody else that has any questions?
Yes, Patrick Cole here. If you go to page 55,
mm-hmm.
Where you had the white areas when you had another search radius, could you use SATA to put out new points for measuring, for sampling?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a number of sample designs. Some are initial, and some are secondary. They've got like 20 or 30 now. My favorite one is AOC Boundary, where you use this as an input into this sampling design. Say you want to, you've got a distribution like this, and you're concerned about those areas that are not filled in, or you're concerned about areas where there's not enough data points and there's rapid changes. Well, with the AOC boundary sampling tool, it takes this, you create this first, you input it into that module, and you just, again, it's only about five parameters you have to set. And the most important one, you give it, here's my decision, here's my action level. I'm interested in 40 parts per billion, or 40 parts per million, and I want to take 10 samples. The algorithm will place those 10 samples where there's the greatest uncertainty. In other words, it calculates where the samples are the furthest distance apart, but at the same time you're getting the most rapid change in concentration, and then shows you on the screen where those samples should be collected, and also you can export those points as an Excel file or a shape file. That's just one example. That's the one that I've used the most that I really like to use a lot. But there's certainly, you know, random sampling, there's stratified random sampling, almost as many choices as you have in Visual Sample Plan, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, so you could do this work in SATA. You don't need Visual Sample Plan.
I would say for most of them. We don't really have, I mean, Visual Sample Plan has a more interactive manipulation of the gray area in your alpha and beta, those sorts of things. But especially for the secondary, which I used, I think Visual Sample Plan has really added a lot, but it used to be more of a tool designed for your initial, you go out and here's my initial random sampling grid or my initial stratified. SATA always came in with a lot of good secondary sampling tools, and if you can do your site geostatistically, if you can do the variography and Krieg your data, it opens up a whole world of sampling tools that use the uncertainties that geostatistics will quantify for you. It really expands your choices by about a factor of three.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, well, I guess we'll bring this to a close then, and, you know, as Jim put in slide 62, he's got links there. Those will be forever captured in the webinar document. I'd like to first and foremost thank everybody here for participating. We had a very well-attended call, almost 70 people in five different countries, so I think that's wonderful. And I definitely want to thank both Marty from Bay West and Jim from Tetra Tech for providing their time to deliver this presentation. I'd like to direct everybody to slide 64. There's two links there. Those are hot links. One is to additional resources to where you can go for additional information. And then the second link, which is that feedback form. If you could just take 2 minutes after this call and do that before you close down, that would be wonderful. And then lastly, I made a plug for the Triad Community of Practice very briefly in the beginning. And the Community of Practice meets monthly, and now we've moved it to every other month. And it's an open forum, federal, state, local, consultants, vendors. We even have a tie-in to the European Community of Practice. They participate on our calls, and we learn what they're doing in Europe. And if you want to find out more information about the Triad Community of Practice, how to get on the email distribution list, I encourage you to email Thomas Heim, and his email is thomas.heim@emsus.com. Or there's a link to my email as well as moderator, and I'll make sure that Tom gets that. EMS is EPA's contractor and helps facilitate that forum, which is a very good one for additional collaboration like this. But with that, unless there's any other last-minute questions, I'd like to close this and, again, thank everybody for their time and interest in this seminar.